And it's a concert which features Richard Stoltzman. We'll spend some time with him. But I want to go back to 1976 and hear him a little bit from 1976. Richard Stoltzman, you remember when you recorded the Crystal Liturgy of from the Quartet for the End of Time?
It was a end of time, long time. But yeah, I do remember it, actually. It's kind of a strange story, in fact, because Max Wilcox was the producer, and we wanted to do it in Japan. So we recorded the whole thing in Japan, but the stage that we recorded on was an opera house auditorium stage, and it had a circular floor that moved. It could rotate to change sets. And so it turned out, after reviewing all of the takes that we made for 2 days, that there were sounds emanating from the floor that hadn't been detected. So we did the whole thing again in New York, probably in Studio A at RCA. But it was so expensive for RCA to send us all to, and Max felt, I've got to. So if you look on the cover, it says recorded both in Japan and New York.
Oh, okay. But I guess where I really want to go with this is, were you, Annie Kavafian, Peter Serkin, and Fred Sherry, four wild and crazy guys, kind of discovering things? Who were you? And talk about discovering the Quartet for the End of Time.
Well, I think it was all because of Peter and his passion for Messiaen, actually, but also for finding a group of like-minded souls who cared more about constantly re-examining and exploring a piece of music that was worthwhile to do, really caring more about that than even performing it. So when we got together in New York, we probably played this piece for more than 6 months. Not because we didn't know it, because we just kind of wanted to let it grow and also let us grow together as four individuals, but tied together by this music. And we, you know, we did a lot of, not a lot, but a certain amount of experimentation to open our minds.
Well, and that obviously it was the times of opening our minds, and it was also, it's that kind of piece that doesn't that allow or demand?
I think so. And of course it was because of Peter and his relationship with what's her name? Yvonne Loriot? The wife of Messiaen, that he was able to get Messiaen to come and hear us and coach us.
Oh, really? Talk about that for a little bit.
Well, that happened in New York City, actually, 941 Park Avenue in New York, at the home of John and Ann Strauss, who were big, loved chamber music, and I had the good fortune of being able to use their living room to rehearse many quartets. The Amadeus came there to record, the Tokyo, the Guarneri, the Vermeer. anyway, so it was this precious place, and it had just turned out from the forces of, you know, the cosmos or something, that Tora Takemitsu was also available in the United States. So he came to that coaching. So it was just the Tashi group, Messiaen,
and Takemitsu.
Takemitsu, you would never know he was there. He sat in one of the overstuffed chairs in a corner and was just so quiet.
And had he been a student of Messiaen?
He had been a lover of his music. He was literally ecstatic about his music, and had begun trying to capture some of those sounds that Messiaen could create in his orchestral mind. And I think Takemitsu succeeded, really, I think. But at that point, he hadn't written anything for our group. And when he heard us play, he decided he was going to write a piece called Quatrain, which later we performed with Seiji in Boston and then also in Japan. And then Takemitsu eventually wrote a beautiful concerto called Phantasma Cantos, which has all of those elements that I think he heard in the Messiaen. That, I mean, in terms of the clarinet, the expressive dynamics, and kind of bird-like or improvisatory sounds, but also the orchestral prisms of colors that Messiaen was able to work with. But Messiaen was, you know, it was not a frivolous coaching. I think John Strauss, the owner of the apartment, has said, does Messiaen know that you guys have devoted like 3 years of your life to playing this piece already? You're not students, you know. But we were deferential to Messiaen. And Messiaen was just very, very rigorous with us. There was not a bunch of like, oh, fantastique, marvelous, you know, blah, blah, blah. He really dived in, especially with Peter pedaling and precise notations. With the clarinet, my main memory, because I was too scared to remember much, but I remember him coming up. He's a pretty tall guy, and I'm sitting there, and I played the third movement, the Abîme des Oiseaux, and he sort of hovered over me, and he said, "Noir! Noir! Noir! Noir!"
Meaning black?
Yeah. And I thought, what am I, I don't know, you know. And what he was talking about was the return of the theme when it comes back in the Chalumeau register of the clarinet. And the way I'd played it was soft and kind of fluffy, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, you know, it's black. You have to play black here. Noir, you know. And so I started sweating bullets trying to find out what that was going to be interpreted as. And I with my embouchure and squeezing and pushing and grunting, doing kinds of things. And I don't think I probably ever succeeded, but he seemed to let up eventually. And you know, but he was also, I was a little bit more free with rhythms than I guess, you know. And he came over, and this one notation which has an eighth note and then it has a dotted eighth note and then it has a half note, you know. It's like, dun, 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 dun. And he, under, 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 toi, under, toi, under, toi, you know.
He made you subdivide it.
Totally, yeah. But very rigorously. And I was in a kind of a hazy thinking about this piece as being so... so romantic in a way. Mm. And he of course was romantic, but he needed it on his terms and with the notation as precise as possible. And I think this pleased us all, actually, and Peter especially, because he was such a demon for the detail of the score, the truth in the score, which he probably got from his dad, that this is what we go back to when we differ in our opinions or we can't really seem to find our way to create the piece. Go back to the score. Go back to the score.
My guest, Richard Stoltzman, who's playing Copland with the Gonzaga Symphony tonight and some other things. We'll talk about that. But you alluded, when you were talking about Messiaen, about Takemitsu and all of the different sounds, you've always been notable for liberating the clarinet, if I may say so, of creating more different colors and sounds on the clarinet than many of us had known prior to that. Talk about that. That you've done in your career.
Yeah, I'm sure it came from listening to the voice. And my dad and mom sang in the church choir. My dad loved playing Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra. And so I heard the voice a lot and what it could do and how it phrased. And when I was probably just only in fifth grade or something, when I had learned a little bit about the clarinet, my dad brought me to the rehearsal of the church choir on Wednesday night because the alto section was sparse. It basically was, my mom was there. So needed some reinforcement of the alto. So he just had me play, they opened up they were hymns, you know, opened up the hymn book and I was supposed to play the alto line.
On the clarinet.
And I think I did. But what I learned in retrospect about that was that luckily I didn't know enough about the clarinet to realize that I had a B-flat instrument and this was a C score. I didn't know, which was good, because if I'd have known, I would have played all the wrongness. And I also knew more or less that when you raised your fingers, the notes go up. And when your notes go up, you raise your finger. When the notes go down, you put your fingers down. So I kind of did that. And the primary thing I did was listen to the voice that was singing alongside and follow that. And with that just automatic trying to sound like the voice and breathe like the voice, I incorporated, I think, for the rest of my life, this feeling that the clarinet is an instrument of sound and like vowel sounds and colors more than it is. Of course, it's an instrument of technique too, but that especially.
And my guest, Richard Stoltzman, and as long as we're thinking about songs, let's hear a George Gershwin song, take a little break from this. Do you want, we could either do The Promenade, Walking the Dog, or we could do I've Got Rhythm, or any of the old Tosche songs. Got a suggestion on one of these?
Well, Walking the Dog was my mother's favorite one to do with my kids. When she'd put that on, they'd do a little parade around the living room.
Perfect. Let's hear this with my guest, Richard Stoltzman.
Thank you.
The Promenade by Gershwin, called, subtitled Walking the Dog, played by my guest Richard Stoltzman, along with Tashi, which by then had, for this recording, had expanded to a string quintet, or string quintet. Was this the last thing that was done under the name Tashi?
No. Oh. I don't think so.
Okay, so you kept doing, keeping it together. And the original four of you still, or just...
Well, the original four of us played together again. We didn't record together, but the group with string quartet and clarinet did. We did a record with Lucas Foss, because Lucas wrote a piece for our group and included himself on piano, which was really fun. He called the piece Tashi, and we did that on tour together, and played a lot of concerts that way.
And let's I was alluding to the different sounds that you've been notable for making on the clarinet, and then we're talking aloud about various musical things. Talk about the clarinet's place in our society, in our musical world, within your lifetime, because hasn't its role expanded, and hasn't it been a great bunch of decades for the clarinet?
Gosh, I'd never thought about it in such sweeping terms. You know, I just found the clarinet underneath my mom and dad's bed, and it was the lightest thing that I could take to school at elementary school and play on. So that was about it for me. But I do remember, though, that my dad had told me that, you know, Benny Goodman was a clarinet player, and he loved Benny Goodman's big band. And I can remember, I think I was, we were still living in San Francisco, and my grandma was watching the TV. Her favorite show was the Lawrence Welk show. And she cried out to me to come down the hall, you know, Richie. And on the screen was Pete Fountain playing with the Lawrence Welk Orchestra. And this was, I was just mesmerized. First of all, he had a crystal mouthpiece instead of a black plastic, but a crystal. And his sound was so liquid. It was, I never heard, I didn't know this was it was obviously looked like a clarinet, but it didn't sound like I thought they were supposed to. And I think looking back at probably, this was one of the beginning times when I realized, wow, the clarinet can sound like anything. And it can have the most diverse qualities and still be, you know, wonderful instrument. So for me, I think the clarinet was a perfect instrument because if it had any stereotype, I kind of felt like I could free it from that stereotype. I remember I'd had substitute professor when my professor at Yale took a sabbatical, and he brought in a very high level clarinetist from one of the orchestras, and I was playing for him, and he stopped me and he said, "You know, son, if you don't learn how to fit in, you're never going to get a job." And I thought back at that later on. I said, "Wow, that's it. I did never fit in. That's the secret to it." It's not the secret, but it that's, and a clarinet has that ability to fit in or not to fit in. That's the answer.
Wow, that's perfect, and it does certainly, you know, kind of prove what you've done throughout your career with all this repertoire and all this stuff.
You remember Glenn Miller, the Glenn Miller sound was because he surprisingly inserted the clarinet in the vocal structure, not the vocal, the chord structure of the saxophones.
And it worked so well. Yeah. And you've played some jazz in your life.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have a regular gig doing that?
I don't have a band, but I play with my son. He's a great jazz pianist. He lives in Denver, Colorado. In fact, we're doing a concert in a week and a half in Michigan. And so he's been my inspiration in terms of playing, you'd say jazz, improvisation, but using chord changes that are fascinating. But he also plays classical. We do the Debussy Rhapsody, and not in public, but we've played it And sort of leaving the earth with the Debussy and kind of going into some, beautiful, I guess you'd say French sonorities, but had nothing to do with, and a little more groove. And one of the things I think I learned from my son is that the idea of time passing and how it passes in classical music as opposed to jazz is that you're not dissecting quite the un, deux, trois, un, deux, trois.
The way Messiaen was.
Yeah, which that was necessary for his music. But for jazz, it's just more... And it's one, two, three, could be, but it could be... The feeling is a sense of time that follows a inside groove rather than an exterior metronome. When classical players get that kind of feeling, it's tremendously exciting. Mm. And conversely, when a jazz player hones in on the metricality of a piece. Like I would say examples of that, like Chick Corea can play his own compositions, like children's songs or something like that, and they have all the sparkle and the I don't know what you want to call it, the authenticity of a classical piece. You know, it's quite astounding. Mm.
And so within that lovely description that you've just given us, where does the Copland Clarinet Concerto fit?
Well, the Copland fits in both because it starts off in this, he studied with Boulanger and he, I'm sure, was steeped in the European aesthetic, the form. I mean, he chooses a slow waltz for the form of the piece, the first movement. It's very tonal, and he emphasizes the wide spaces of perfect fourths and perfect fifths, which give the feeling of the piece a great serenity and kind of vista, and especially the opening with the harp. Having the harp is something that just really grounds you in European, the world, the classical world. And I remember my mom used to tell me, or ask me, she said, when are you going to play that harp piece again? I said, Mom, it's a clarinet concerto. And he said, I just love that harp piece. Yeah. So, and that really leaves the audience in a kind of beautiful past that they enjoy and maybe sometimes fall asleep to. But anyway, then he has this bridge to the second movement, which is, for me, that is the magical moment when classical music was transformed, reborn as jazz, as American. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about the Copland Concerto is I don't have to think about how would... You know, if English clarinetists, how would they play the Finzi concerto, or how would a French clarinetist play the Debussy, or how would a German clarinetist play the Weber concerto? You know, I think, well, how would an American clarinetist play? Oh, well, I'm American. I don't have to think about that. I just play it. So, and it starts with the clue that he is so smart with Copland is he starts playing the same theme again without the harp and without the orchestra, just the clarinet. Very liquid. Then he marks these lines underneath all the notes. He hadn't done that at all before. And he says, begin to feel a rhythm. And so instead of da-dee-da-da-da, he goes... Ta 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 ta, and then he adds accents on the offbeats. So now you've got syncopation. And he puts that all together then with an exploding high note, a sort of a Benny Goodman type high note, and launches into chord changes, really, is what it is, which is what Benny was always playing. I remember talking to his daughter, Rachel, and she said, I knew my dad was wonderful, you know, and everything, but she was a classical pianist, and sometimes they would play together, some Brahms or something. But she said one day she wandered over to his music stand to see what he had been working on, and all she saw were letters, A flat 7, D minor 9, you know. And it just stunned her to realize that all this music that she loved that he played wasn't written down. It was developed from chord changes. So Copland takes, you know, like major chords and goes up and down and puts them in inversions and plays with them in that way. And then especially gets the shouting of the accents, you know. And so you know you're in America, and he kind of shoves that into your frame of reference, and then lets the scale go up to the introducing the strings in a new world.
The Copland Clarinet Concerto, which dominates the second half of tonight's concert, 7:30 at the Fox, and then you're going to play a few other tunes, aren't you?
With a little help.
Yeah.
The West Side Story, of course, you know, was probably just about the same time as the Copland in the 1940s. And it's such gorgeous melodies. And I've always wanted to play it, but there, you know, it's there isn't a clarinet version. So a great friend of mine from Yale days, Frank Bennett, recreated, he calls it a West Side Variance, and took all the juicy melodies and rhythms and gave them to me, and then of course with a full orchestra, which gives it a lot of like technicolor.
Sure, yeah. So that will also be on there after the Copland.
Yeah, and then one other thing we're doing is just my little tribute to Benny Goodman, because he was the person for whom the Copland Concerto was written, you know? Mm-hmm. And therefore, as much as I think he was somewhat he wasn't really given his due by classical players. It would be as if somebody had come to Benny Goodman and said, you know, if you don't learn how to fit in, you're never going to get a job. That kind of attitude. And he used vibrato.
Yeah, which is one of the big no-nos that you've also done, right?
Yeah, sure, you can.
And that's like what I was alluding to earlier, because now you liberated that for all clarinetists to doubt. Now do, didn't you?
I don't know if I
did. You were part of the liberating process.
Maybe, I don't know.
The Che Guevara of the clarinet?
But, but you know, vibrato, I learned from... Moise, Marcel Moise taught at the Marlborough Music Festival where I was for 10 summers I was there. And his thing of vibrato was that it means life. If you're not vibrating, you're not alive. And therefore, but it's a total continuum from something that's very pale and intensely narrow to something that's ebullient and joyful and full of colors, but it's all in the thing of vibrato. So when people say, oh, you do vibrato, I say, no, I don't do vibrato. Vibrato is in the sound. We all, so.
Richard Stoltzman, who will be demonstrating all that tonight at the 7:30 concert at the Fox. And you've been here with the symphony some years ago, and then you were at the Festival at Sandpoint just a very few years ago doing Balcombe and Claire Fisher. And we have that recording. You said you'd talk a little bit about Claire Fisher as we go.
Yeah, I think Claire Fisher isn't as well known as he ought to be in the American music world. But someone who was aware of his genius was Prince. And while Claire Fisher was writing the clarinet sonata, which I commissioned, he told me, I asked him, when do you think it's going to be done? He says, "What? I'm getting to it, but I've got this," he said, I just have to tell you, I've got this kind of choice gig right now, Prince." He sort of said that to me like, you know, you probably don't know who Prince is, but, and it's Prince has allowed me or hired me to get my own orchestra in the studio every day for close to a month and record. And I said, what are you recording? He said, I love your harmonies. I love your sounds. Record things that you like. I want to hear them all. And I also want to own them.
Wow.
So he paid for the orchestra and for Claire to have these, you know, where all this music is, I don't know. Although when Prince died last week, people were saying that there's a vault or something which has incredibly unknown vast amounts of music that he made. But probably in there are all these recording sessions from Claire Fisher.
Nice. And what we have here by Claire Fisher is the Duke, Sweet Pea, and Me. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I wanted... I thought that if anybody could do Duke Ellington for, I was thinking of Pops concerts, mm-hmm. Claire would be perfect. And he was, but he also knew that I was going to be doing this with real professional classical orchestras. And he wanted to use that element of it. He said, I don't want to do whole notes for the orchestra and a drum set in the front playing the rhythm, and you see that oftentimes in pop scores. And
so they can do it on one rehearsal.
Yeah, and the orchestra basically they're looking up in the sky, you know, and the drums are so it's not real. So he said I'm going to try to incorporate this and use, of course, the music of Billy Strayhorn, too, because he was fantastic. And he said there's going to be some of me in there. He was not short of ego, and he shouldn't have been, because he was a brilliant, brilliant, you know, musician.
So hence the name The Duke, Sweet Pea.
And Me.
And Me. Yeah. Claire Fisher's music.